Class is back in session. It's time for Baptist Basics University from BaptistBasics.org. Welcome back to Baptist Basics, Baptist Basics University from BaptistBasics.org. I'm already messing up and I'm not even into the intro. I'm Matthew Gage. I appreciate you listening today as we cover our second lesson going through the book of Daniel, as we take a look at chapter number 1. Now, I hope you've listened to the previous lesson in this, the introduction, to give you a good historical basis for where we are. And just let you know, we're going to cover more history, woohoo, in this one. And even maybe a little bit of science and math. So, all kinds of good stuff here to cover in as we take a look at chapter 1. Now, chapter 1, the main thing to know on this is where Daniel takes a stand, where the food that was being provided by the king, he said, no, I'm not going to eat that, I will not defile myself with it. And we're going to take a look at what's going on, the position that Daniel is in, why he would make that decision. And then I'm going to wrap up by getting a little bit preachy and just take a few applications and observations that I make off of Daniel's stand that he takes. And just give you some food for thought. So let's just go ahead and begin. Book of Daniel, chapter number 1. Verse number 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. Verse 2. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. Now, if you want to see a little bit further detail on this, we can go back to 2 Kings chapter number 24 and verse 1. It talks about this siege and Nebuchadnezzar taking Jerusalem here. Other things to note in here, it talks about taking vessels from the house of God. Now, what's happening there, it's not like they went in and took the golden candlesticks or the brazen altar or the table of showbread. They didn't take the vital instruments. They took extra things. The worship continues at the temple for the time being, for a few more years before they destroy it. So they didn't take the vital instruments and things needed for worship at the temple. They just took the extra bowls, the extra things that were around, extra utensils that would be gold and silver and such. And there was quite a bit of that. But they did raid, the treasury at the temple. And that is one thing. I mean, you think about it. The Jews had their temple tax, a half shekel of silver that they would pay each year for the upkeep and maintenance and running the temple. So, I mean, even at the time of Christ, there was quite a bit of money there, quite a bit of wealth, and all these implements, I mean, would be made out of precious metals, out of gold and such. So, there is quite a bit of wealth there. So, when Nebuchadnezzar comes, he's going to raid and take the wealth of the city and the wealth of the temples. And he takes it back to the land of Shinar. We talked about in the previous lesson, that's kind of the ancient biblical name for the land of Babylon. To the house of his god. That god is the sun god called Marduk. M-A-R-D-U-K is one spelling of it. So he takes those treasures from the temple and takes them back and puts them in his temple, into the treasury of the temple of his god, of the main god of the Babylonian pantheon, which was Marduk. Verses number 3. And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed and of the princes. Verse 4, children in whom was no blemish, but well favored and skilled in all wisdom and cunning and knowledge and in understanding science, and such as had an ability in them to stand in the king's palace, with whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans, or Chaldeans, as really how you supposed to say that. The CH is a K sound. So here's the plan let's go in reverse five. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. So here's the plan. Not only do they take the wealth, but they're going to go in and take the next generation of leaders out of Judah. They're going to take them back to Babylon to be trained and implemented and placed in the Babylonian government, and Babylonian society, and Babylonian academia. So they're taking these young people to teach and to train them, and not to send them back, but to actually just kind of rob that talent and rob that ability for their own use. Now, the word children there means young people. Most people estimate that Daniel is probably a teenager. I've seen estimates, 12, 16. It Bible does not say that I'm aware of how old he is. So, that's just kind of an estimate. Most people assume he's a teenager. We know he lives past the 70-year captivity, so he can't be much older than a teenager, or he's going to get pretty old. He's going to be in his 90s or, past the century mark if he's very old. So, most people assume he's probably in his teens. So, let's look at the kind of what they're doing here. The plan is Ashpenaz, who's kind of the head of the eunuchs. I'm gonna talk some of the meanings of some of these names. I skipped over Nebuchadnezzar. We're going to get into this in just a little bit, but I'll go ahead and mention this. Nebuchadnezzar, his name means Nabu, who's a god. Defend my firstborn son. That's kind of what his name means. Ashpenaz, we're not really sure what that name means. It's maybe Persian or something along those lines. I couldn't really find a reliable name meaning on that, so it's not in the notes. But one definition that kept coming up is that his name means horse nose. So very comical if that really was his name. But some of the references, Hitchcock's Bible names and things like that, I believe it said that, and a few other ones said that Ashpenaz means horse nose. So I kind of hope for his sake that's not what that means. But this Ashpenaz is head of the eunuchs. A eunuch is a castrated male, okay? They've been castrated. We're not going to go into details there. But these would be people that would be put into service, into civil service. Basically, since they can't reproduce and, some of that desire is no longer there, they're not going to marry. They're not going to have families, of course. So they're going to kind of be dedicated to their work. So this Ashpenaz fella is over them and probably one himself. And so the plan is to take these children of Israel, and they're going to become eunuchs also, most likely. I don't believe it says, but, he's the master of the eunuchs, and they're recruiting new members, so it would... just as a side note, it would assume that Daniel and his friends probably also would become eunuchs in this process. Okay, no, let's not go too much in detail there. I've been around, when they've castrated bulls, made them steers, and I'm not very comfortable with that, let alone talking about human anatomy going there. So anyway, we'll just mention that. Let's note who they're taking. Of the king's seed and of the princes, these are the nobility. These are the aristocracy. So they've got the best blood in them. No blemish and well-favored. Physically, there is, nothing wrong with them. They're not cripples. They're good-looking, smart people, skillful in wisdom and cunning and knowledge. They're very bright people, that they can be taught, they can be learned. These would be, straight A students. It talks about having the ability to stay in the king's palace. I think this is, personality, demeanor, that, they're worthy and they know of being in a royal palace and know how to act in a royal palace. I think that kind of goes in line there. They're going to teach them the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. So we're going to take a history side tour here and talk about the Chaldeans. The Chaldeans originally are a Semitic people, kind of from, I think, north of Babylon. Well, they allied with Babylon in some of the battles against Assyria. And by this time, they're really... Chaldean is less of a person and less of an ethnicity as it is a status, as a, you know, these are the academia. These are the astronomers. These are the mathematicians. These are the priests. These are the smart people of the time. So it doesn't necessarily mean they have to be Chaldean by blood. It just means that... you know, they're of this status, of this caste. So eventually they're completely assimilated into Babylon and they kind of lose that ethnic identity. You talk about that. Really by the fall of Babylon. So during this period is when, you know, Chaldean kind of means the class and less of of ethnicity. They spoke what's known as the Akkadian language. Or I hope I'm saying that close to right. A-K-K-A-D-I-A-N. And they wrote that language in cuneiform. And if you remember that from history class, it's basically, you know, you take like a clay tablet and you're taking like and making markings in that clay tablet, usually just like poking symbols into it. But they would write many, many, many of these tablets have survived. And some interesting stuff has been preserved on that. The Chaldeans at the time... are pretty much the most advanced, brilliant, as far as the sciences go. Now Egypt is pretty well advanced, but really for this time period, the Chaldeans are about the best and brightest going. Some things that they were very advanced in, one was astronomy. I read one account somewhere, I forgot to write down where it was and who exactly all this was, but there was an astronomer of these Chaldeans that actually accurately calculated the length of the solar year to within just a few minutes. So, you know, think about that without, you know, stopwatches or computers or anything like that. I mean, to calculate that, that's an amazing feat. They studied the stars without the aid of a telescope, mind you. And they were the first people in charting the stars to identify that some of those things that shine up there seem to be moving. So they were the first to identify planets and separate them from stars. I believe they called them wanderers. So amazing little step forward in the sciences of astronomy. They had a in-depth knowledge of the stars and astrology and astronomy and all that. So, and a lot of that does play in talking about astrology. It does play into some of the religious practices and such too. But that's something that they're known for advancing. Also, they're known for their mathematics. And they used a number system that was based on 60. It's a sexagesimal, ruin that word. But basically, the root of it, instead of it being 10 or 100, you know, like our modern system is, or, you know, our decimal system, you know, is based on tens and hundreds and thousands, and, you know, multiples of 10. Theirs was based on 60. And think, well, what does that have to do with anything? Number one, it's cool. Number two, it's the basis for some modern things. You ever wonder why we have 60 minutes in an hour? Goes back to the Chaldeans and their 60-based number system. You know why there's 360 degrees in a circle? That goes back to the 60 base. You know, 36 is 60 times 6. So it goes back to that. So we are still in modern society, modern math, modern geometry, still influenced by these people. Some of the tablets have been that have been discovered show some advanced math in practice. It appears by some of this, some stuff I read, they knew how to do some square roots. They possibly, even some of the stuff they dug up seems to show that they knew the Pythagorean theorem, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, you know, when you're calculating with the angles of triangles. So that's pretty advanced. That's stuff, you know, nowadays, you know, you're learning in algebra one, algebra two, you know, something like that. But I mean, for the time, that level of conceptual math, very, very advanced. And it seems like they were passing this on and preserving it on these tablets also. Speaking of those tablets, they found with some with algebra and geometry, and some amazing stuff has been found. Also, I read a couple different places that they had a concept for pi when dealing with, you know, area. And we know, you know, that was the area of a circle is pi r squared. Pi and radians, the radius squared. Anyway, we know pi is about 3.14, number keeps going, you know, forever. But 3.14 is what I always remember, because that's what, when, you know, when I did algebra and stuff, that's it. I'll just use 3.14. That's close enough. You know. Well, there's some sources that say that they knew pi was about 3. Well, that's pretty close. You know, 3.14 to 3.00, that's still pretty doggone close. I can actually, though, take you back to the Bible and show you that the Jews even knew when they were building the temple or building the tabernacle, they had a concept of pi being about 3 also, though. And the Egyptians also seem to have known that also. So that's not a big deal. But there's also another source I saw that said that they thought that pi actually was about 3 1/8. That makes it about 3.125. 3.125 to 3.14. They're within just, you know, a couple of hundredths, actually a hundredth, you know, whatever. But they're very, very close to actually calculating pi. And pi is a number that, I mean, you know, they use computers now to really try to calculate it and get it as accurate as possible and stuff. But just a conceptual number like that, they had a very good grasp of what it was. That's how far advanced they were in their math, in their geometry. These were the best and the brightest people of their time. Now, why am I talking about them? Because this is what Daniel is going to be learning. This is what his friends with him are going to be learning. These Jewish captives that were taken with Daniel to go into this training, you know, go take this college course or whatever you want to call it. This is what they were learning. They're being taken out of Judea, taken to Babylon. They're going to learn the Akkadian language. They're going to learn how to write in cuneiform. They're going to learn this astronomy. They're going to learn this mathematics. They're going to learn about the history and the religion and the culture of Babylon. They're going to be absorbed, is what the plan is, for them to be absorbed into this class, this aristocratic level class of people, and to be trained in these sciences, trained in these arts, trained in this culture. So this is the kind of stuff that Daniel would wake up every morning and go to school, or however it exactly worked, and this would be what he would be learning, is this number system and their calculations and their math. So that's the level of stuff that Daniel would be learning. That's why I want to go into some detail, just give you some background. This 3-year training process, when they come out the other end, these people are supposed to be ready to be integrated into Babylonian society in amongst these, you know, what we call wise men, scientists, you know, by modern terms, be integrated in with them. And then we also see, you know, the king is going to provide for them the daily provision, the king's meat and the wine which he drank. So, you know, they're getting room and board and an education for free. They're just captives and being absorbed into a different culture, and they become eunuchs. And, you know, there's some drawbacks, but, you know, if you want an education, they're getting a pretty good deal on one, I guess. They're coming at, their land's been conquered. They're coming out with their life. So the education is just bonus, I guess you could say. But anyway, the plan is a 3-year course. They're going to learn all this stuff. And in the end of that, they're going to stand before Nebuchadnezzar, you know, and be tested. And Nebuchadnezzar's going to see how well this plan works. Verse 6. Now, among these were of the children of Judah, Daniel, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah. Verse 7, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs, old Ashpenaz, it seems like Daniel, when he's writing this, felt sorry for Ashpenaz and doesn't use his name, he just keeps calling him, you know, the prince of the eunuchs, gave names, for he gave unto Daniel the name of Belteshazzar, and to Hanani of Shadrach, and to Mishael of Meshach, and to Azariah of Abednego. And I never can say it. I always want to say Abednego, but it's Abednego. I want to talk a little bit about what these names mean, because ancient names had meanings. Daniel, we've already mentioned in the introduction, his name means, you know, God is my judge. They changed his name to Belteshazzar, which means favored by Bel. And Bel is a name that means, it means Lord or Master. And what's assumed by historians is that this is probably referring to the god Marduk, you know, the main god, the sun god. So he's favored by Marduk. So his name, instead of being about the true god, now has a pagan god, a false god, a fake god associated with it. And that's the same for his friends. Hananiah means God who is gracious. It's changed to Shadrach, which means commanded... commanded by Aku, who is the moon god. Mishael means who is like God. Now they kind of do a cruel trick with his name. They change his name to Meshach, which is who is what Aku, the moon god again, is. So they change from basically from, you know, who's like God to who's like Aku. So they kind of do a little cruel twist on his name. Azariah means God has helped, to Abednego, and that is a servant of Nabu. Now, there's actually some debate, Nego, or there's a few different possible gods that could be referring to, but Nabu is the one that people seem to be most prominent, maybe most likely that's referring to, and Nabu, which I already talked to, Nebuchadnezzar. But that's the god of wisdom and writing is kind of who he's associated with. So anyway, so part of this losing their Jewish identity is they're learning about the foreign culture and the foreign sciences. They also are getting foreign names. I mean, they really want these people to stop being Jews and to become Babylonians, to become Chaldeans. But, verse 8, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. So in the middle of this training, Daniel purposes in his heart and says, this is too far. Now, you know, it's one thing, I'll go along, I'll learn the geometry, I'll learn the math, I'll learn the astronomy, I'll learn the language, I'll learn how to write it. But I'm a Jew, and I'm going to maintain my Jewish identity, and I'm not going to defile myself with the food that is being offered to me. Now, this always kind of baffled me. It's like, well, why would he not eat this food? Now, we know, and hopefully you know, that the Jews, they had their very strict customs that they live by under the Mosaic Law, and there's very strict dietary laws about things that can be eaten. You know, they couldn't eat pork. Was it shellfish they couldn't eat? The blood was supposed to be removed from any meat that they ate. They were supposed to eat this animal, not this animal. A bunch of different things. They weren't supposed to eat, you know, like vultures and catfish and a bunch of things. Just going off the top of my head. But anyway, there's very strict dietary guidelines that they have. So, what is it about this food that Daniel would say, I'm sorry, I cannot eat that? Four possible things. It's from animals that were deemed unclean by the law. So, you know, this was pork, for instance. You know, they weren't supposed to eat, pigs and pork. So maybe that's what it was. And I said, oh, sorry, it's pork chops, it's bacon, I can't eat it. That's possible. Perhaps, number two, the meat was prepared with the blood in it. Now, the blood was considered sacred. Deuteronomy says the life of the flesh is in the blood. They were supposed to respect that. If they ate meat, they were supposed to boil it and get the blood out of the meat. Perhaps that could be the case. That's likely too. Possibility number three, the meat or the animals that were, slaughtered, had been offered to these false gods, of the Babylonians. And Daniel, as a Jew, said, oh, I'm sorry, it's been offered to a pagan god. I'm not supposed to eat that. I should not eat that. So that's likely also. I mean, most cultures do that type of thing, and will dedicate their food. You know, the Greeks and the Romans did it, and other ancient cultures, even we today, ask the blessing on our food. Ask God to bless the food before we eat. So it's very likely that the food was dedicated to a pagan god. That would make sense. The fourth reason, I think probably the biggest one, and the one I've kind of been leading up to as I've kind of been explaining this, is I think it probably has something to do to resist losing his Jewish and thus his godly identity. Daniel was a Jew, yes. But Daniel was a godly man. And to Daniel, he could go along in his life. He integrated into the Babylonian society. But he still remained a faithful man of God. So I really think the thing is, when he's doing this, it's like, maybe there's something about it, he's not supposed to eat it, but that was not the diet of the Jews. And he wanted to keep the commandments he had been raised to keep. He wanted to keep those customs, keep those traditions that he, as a Jew, had been commanded to keep. So that may be his biggest reason, and I think probably underlying any of the other reasons, this had to play into it, that Daniel just said, I'm a Jew, I'm sorry, I can't do that. Just the same as we as Christians today, we can integrate into society, but there comes a point where we have to draw a line and separate and say, look, I can go so far and we can get along to a certain point, but there's a limit to what I can do because I am a Christian. I can be friends with you. We can eat a meal together, but I'm not going to go to the bar and get drunk with you. something along those lines. There is a limit even today. I think we can understand that. Well, Daniel is in the place. He's a captive. He's in a foreign land. They're wanting to teach and train these people to stop being Jews and become Babylonians, to become Chaldeans. And Daniel says, okay, look, I'll learn all this stuff. I'll do what you want to do, but I'm still a Jew. I still worship the true God. And I'm still going to serve him as I've been commanded to, the customs that have been handed down to me by my fathers. So I think that really is the main thing going on in Daniel's mind. So what does Daniel do? Does he throw a fit? No. Does he go on a hunger strike? No. He asks the prince of the eunuchs, and it's like, look, buddy, can we please have some different food? Verse 9. Now, God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. So, the prince of the eunuchs, old Ashpenaz, old horse nose, he takes a liking to Daniel. I picture this as, Ashpenaz is an older guy, Daniel is a younger guy, and just takes him in as a son. Daniel must have had the personality, just people, just, magnetic, just a very likable personality, because even the kings seem to respect him and like him and care about him. So something about him, some kind of just a magnetic personality. And I always kid around saying I have a magnetic personality. It's just that the poles are reversed and it just repels people instead of attracting them. Science joke there. But anyway, this is a verse, just to let you know, the people who want to read too much into the Bible and kind of reinterpret things, try to use this to say, oh, well, look, well, Daniel had a homosexual relationship with this guy. And I'm sorry, I don't see that. If Daniel's taking a stand for his, you know, the purity of his Jewish identity, I think he'd be taking a stand for in that area also, saying, hey, that's been forbidden by the law too. So it makes no sense in context with Daniel, with his life. The fact that they're all eunuchs also kind of plays into it. I think that's just people trying to push a homosexual agenda and read way too much into the Bible than is there. But what I read that to say, and even historically what people have read that to say, is just that, you know, this guy must have loved Daniel as a son and cared for him. And, you know, it's not a sexual kind of love, okay? I hate to even talk about that. It just seems to me so ludicrous that someone could read that kind of stuff into the Bible. But they're out there, and I just, as we're going through here, I just want to address that. Verse 10, and the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, remember, this guy likes Daniel. He would bend over backwards, do anything for Daniel. But listen to what he says. I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your meat and your drink. For why should he see your faces worse liking than the children which are of your sort? Then shall ye make me endanger my head to the king. So he's like, look, I'm afraid of my boss, Nebuchadnezzar. You know, he's a king, yeah, and the ancient kings at this time, they have a tendency to be a little cruel. So he's scared of them. He says, look, you know, I could get in trouble. And he's like, and even there's a part of this, he's caring for Daniel. He's like, look, I don't want to get you in trouble. I don't want to see you not looking like these other guys. You know, if you're not as healthy looking, if you look a little strange, if you don't look, you know, healthy or look different, you know, to bring suspicion on you, you'll be in trouble. But basically, he's just like, look, Daniel, I can't really go along with this. I'm not saying don't. I'm just saying I'm not touching this. I'm not helping. So verse 11, then said Daniel to Melzar. Now, Melzar appears to be probably maybe be a title. The name there means like steward. So that possibly could be a title. Some people say, well, the King James messed up. You know, they translated it. That should be a title and not a name. Perhaps it was a guy's name. They just were very practical in how they named this guy. You know, hey, he's a steward, so we're going to call him steward. You know, so, I'm not really sure exactly what to think about that. But anyway, Melzar, when you see that, this guy is over them. He's the steward. He's taking care of them. So that's his name. And it says, whom the prince of the eunuchs had said over Daniel, Hananiah, and Mishael, and Azariah. And so Daniel says to him, verse 12, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. Verse 13, then let our countenances be looked upon before thee, and the countenance of the children that eat of the portion of the king's meat, and as thou seest, deal with thy servants. So Daniel comes to him with this request and says, look, feed us this other diet for 10 days, just 10 days, and then we'll look. Remember, this is a 3-year, you know, training thing that they're in. So just 10 days, and let's just see, you know, if we don't look as good, if we don't look as healthy, then, hey, we'll give in, we'll eat your food. Now, this is showing, I think, Daniel's faith in following God. I think Daniel knows, like, well, if I eat what God commands, you know, God's going to bless and God's going to, you know, I mean, when you put God's commandments to the test, he's going to come out on top, okay? You know, that God's word is true, and when God told the Jews, and I'm going to tell you just honest, my honest opinion, not that I am, I'm not a Jew, I'm not a practicing Jew or anything like that, but I'm telling you just my faith in God tells me that I think, that doesn't make sense, my faith in God, by my faith in God, I believe that that Jewish diet is it has to be the healthiest diet that a human being can have. Because, you know, the creator of mankind said, hey, Jews, my people, eat this way. So I think that has to be the most the healthiest diet. I don't know any scientific research necessarily back that up. I know that there has been a little bit that proves it is good and it is healthy. It's just my opinion. I think it is the healthiest diet that a human could eat. But anyway, so but the request is, hey, just 10 days, give us this other food. We'll eat it for 10 days, put it to the test. And honestly, I think Daniel, his faith in God says, this is a win. We're winning this before we even start. God's going to bless this. The food that they request is pulse. And pulse is kind of a broad term for a whole family of food. Examples would be beans and peas and lentils. That's the type of stuff we're talking about here. Not the greatest diet in the world. It's actually a very humble diet, which is amazing. We thank Daniel and his friends here. They're aristocracy. They're probably used to eating good and eating, a high-class Jewish diet. And what they're requesting is about as common a diet as possible. It's a very humble request. And as I say, food of the commoners, for the commoners, this is way below king standard, okay? And they're going to drink water instead of the wine. Verse 14. So we consented to them this matter and proved them 10 days. So Melzar says, okay, 10 days, that's reasonable. Here's your bowl of peas and beans, your pulse. And here's your glass of water, and we'll take you in 10 days and give you a physical. So after 10 days, verse 15. And at the end of 10 days, their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. So God honored his commandments. Maybe even God didn't have to do anything. God, they just followed the right diet and, they came out healthier. But anyway, at the end of this test, well, lo and behold, Daniel and his three friends, they look better. They look healthier. They look happier. Now, I'm telling you, in the back of my mind, I was sitting there thinking, I was like, those other Jewish kids, what about them? Did they not take this stand? All we know of is four of them. How many hundreds or thousands were, taken captive and were in this class? I don't know, but did just four take this stand? What about the rest of them? And I thought to myself, I wonder if those other kids are now suddenly eating a diet they're not used to. I wonder if they are getting sick. And Daniel and his friends are the only one not getting sick because they're used to the diet that they're eating. So anyway, just a thought I have. So verse 16. Thus Melzar took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink and gave them pulse. So Melzar's like, I made the deal after 10 days and I'm going to, stand by my word. And hey, the results are great. You look good. You look healthy. So here's your bowl of peas. So verse 17. And as for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. So God blesses these four young men. They stay faithful to him, and the knowledge and skill and learning and wisdom, the stuff that they're learning, they're learning this geometry, they're learning the astronomy, they're learning the sciences, they're learning the language. They're straight A students. If there's an honor roll, they're on it. If there's an honor society, they're on it. If their parents were there getting the report cards, it'd be A pluses. They were doing excellent in their learning and their training. Also, it's added in that of those four, Daniel, something a little extra with him, that Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. God uses Daniel to interpret these things. It's not that Daniel, just had been stayed up late and saw an infomercial on TV about dreams and bought the book and figured all this stuff out and said, well, if you're, dreaming you went to work without your clothes on, that it means this, that you're insecure. And if you have a dream that, your family hates you, well, it means this. Or, that's not, some of the dream interpretation stuff that's out there now is kind of what it gets into. And I've seen articles like that on the internet, so some of that stuff, and it's interesting, but I guess. But anyway, that's not what that's talking about. This is something that the visions and the dreams that people would have that really doesn't take place nowadays. Now that we have the completed Word of God and the Bible, God doesn't work that way anymore. But we're going to see that Daniel, even as we cover the rest of the book of Daniel, this is something God uses him to do, that God reveals these meanings and purposes behind these visions and dreams, even other, other people's dreams. Nebuchadnezzar can have a dream and Daniel can tell him what it is and what it meant. So that's beyond human power, beyond, human knowledge. That's God working through Daniel. Verse 18. Now, at the end of the days that the king had said he should bring them in, so that's after the 3 years, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 19. And the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. So of all these young men who went through this program, who went through this training, who's the four best? Who's top four in the class? Our four Hebrew children, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Verse 20. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. So as he puts them to the test, as they quiz them, as he's trying to see how this training, how did it work? How smart are these people? Well, it just happens to turn out that not only were they the best of their class, of all those captives that had come in and have gone through this process, they're 10 times better than the best there was. So imagine just how far they excelled beyond even the smartest people of their time. So just added there how much God blessed them and how much he used them and the talents that they had, and that when they were tested, they scored 10 times higher on the SAT than the smartest person did. That's an amazing stat there, that they would be that much further ahead, that further, excelling that much further than even the smartest people. If they, the smartest person, would be like comparing, a kindergartner to Einstein, to, the difference in intelligence. So anyway, then we see in verse 21, and Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. Now that, is a fast forward to the end of the book of Daniel, towards the end of his life. A little bit of the book of Daniel actually takes place after that. But basically just says Daniel was there serving in the Babylonian government, in the king's court, and was the best and the brightest, and that his life and his service continues even 70 years later through the Babylonian captivity, that when Daniel is still 90 years old, he's still the best and the brightest that there is in the land. So let me glance back over the notes here. I believe that catches up on everything I had covered. Okay, just to wrap things up, I just want to give you a few observations on Daniel's stand, because it really fascinates me about how Daniel decided to take that stand. When he decided, look, I'm not going to eat that meat. I'm a Jew. I'm not supposed to, for whatever reason. How did he do that stand? Just some practical observations. Daniel's stand was of conviction, not stubbornness. Daniel wasn't trying to be a jerk. He wasn't trying to be obstinate. He wasn't trying to, be counterculture or anything like that. Daniel just, this was a heart belief. This was his faith. This was who he was. And Daniel said, no, I can't do it. It wasn't him just trying to be obstinate and being jerked. I'm going to tell you, too many times these people that talk about taking stands for the Lord, sometimes I wonder if they're not just jerks and that's their way of exhibiting their jerkiness. That doesn't make sense. But anyway, I think you get my point. Sometimes I wonder that, because a lot of these people, this in-your-face form of Christianity, Daniel didn't practice that. I mean, what he did was very humble. Daniel's stand was private, not public. I'm going to tell you, I worry about these people that get on the news taking a stand for their Christian, quote-unquote, beliefs. I hear a while back here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, there was a lady who was on a public bus. I think it was a DART, a Dallas area rapid transit bus, and had her kids there, and the lady seemed to kind of be out there bouncing around from a few denominations evidently, but she's in the bus and she gets out of the Bible and starts reading rather loudly from the Bible and to her kids. And the bus driver tried to tell her, hey, look, you're disturbing people. Please be quiet. He wasn't trying to shut her up because she read the Bible, but she was being making a scene and really was disturbing people. And the next thing you know, she's all over the news about how, boy, her Christianity, she was being persecuted, and because, you know, she was trying to educate her kids in the Bible and people wouldn't let her. And I thought to myself, lady, riding on a public bus isn't the time to be reading the Bible out loud, okay? And if you're doing that and you're asked to shut up, the best thing you can probably do is shut up. So turn the other cheek and go on. So, me and my wife, a couple of years ago, we stayed down at a hotel kind of north of Dallas, and actually Dart also. Funny how that all works out. Got on the Dart public transportation system, got on the little train, and went down. They had to get on the bus and went to this mall and you know, walked around the mall a little bit. And on the way back, we got back on the bus to go back to the station, and there was a kind of a older black man. It was winter time, in December, and even in Texas, sometimes it gets a little cold. I mean, he had a hat and a scarf and a bundled-up jacket. Well, as we're waiting for the bus, he starts kind of mumbling to himself, and what he was doing was trying to street preach and trying to preach the gospel. And, I mean, what he was saying, I have to say, you know, I didn't hear him say anything doctrinally wrong, but he was there, and he was just kind of going to himself and talking, yeah, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, he done come down. I won't say I'm making fun of black people. This really was the way he was talking. Born of that virgin. Boy, he was sinless. Yes, sir, but we got sins. Sure enough do. And, you know, the Bible says that every man's a sinner. And Jesus loved us and died for those sins. And he was just, so I'm not trying to make fun of the guy, but that really is how he talked. And, anyway, it was a distraction, and he gets on the bus with us, and we're like, oh, I hope he gets on another bus. He didn't get on the bus with us. Well, the bus driver told him, evidently run into this guy before, and he even told him, I said, hey, you ain't going to do none of that preaching here. He has Bible out, and he's like, well, the people, nobody's saying not do it, and, you know, they want to hear it. She's like, no, they don't want to hear it, and everybody else, and they're just wanting to be polite, and they don't want him to do it either, because he's annoying. But, even he said, you know, something, you know, he's like, does anybody not want me to do this? And it's one of those situations where, like, well, do you really want the guy to shut up? He is kind of preaching the gospel, but at the same time, he's probably not doing any good the way he is doing it. And I don't agree with, exactly the manner that he's doing it. And I would just sit back and I was thinking, here I am, I'm a preacher, I really don't like what he's doing. And I don't really want to be the one to tell him to be quiet correct him. And I just kind of, we just kind of kept our mouth shut and kind of kept to ourselves. And I was like, man, I hope he doesn't say anything really point blank to me, because I don't know what I'm going to say. But that guy felt like he was taking a stand for his faith and was being out there in public. And I really kind of got away from my first example, which was way more of that. But, you know, Daniel Stan, it was a matter of the heart. It was a matter of who he was. He wasn't out to make a name for himself. He wasn't out to get on the news. He wasn't out to, to get a lawsuit or anything like that. Daniel just said, hey, I'm not going to eat this meat. I'm not going to make a big deal about this. I'm not going to throw the food in the floor and get up and preach it to everybody. He just went to the people in charge of him and said, look, can I please have a bowl of peas instead of that steak? Also, Daniel's stand was not an ultimatum. He humbly asked for the favor. So it wasn't like, him going up there and saying, if you don't do this right now, I am done. You know, I'm walking out of here. You know, he didn't give an ultimatum. He just very humbly asked and let them kind of make the move. I'll tell you kind of a personal illustration on this. When I was in college, I worked at Sears Auto Center for a couple of school years. I say a couple of years, about a year and a half, but a couple of school years. And they had a little radio back there in the shop, back there where we worked. And used to just drive me crazy. I mean, I'm in Bible college and you're trying to be super spiritual and trying to, abstain from all appearance of evil and everything. Well, here they go. They got this little old radio going, and sometimes it'd be on the country station, which, hate to mention, you know, that's kind of more along my style there, you know, so that wasn't too terribly bad. But it was bad, you know, still bad worldly music, shouldn't be listening to it, you know, especially most of that stuff, you know. A lot of stuff about sex and drinking, a lifestyle that a Christian really doesn't need to associate with. It wasn't supposed to be about that. But anyway, but then every now and then, you know, they'd have it on the pop station. And, boy, that intelligent stuff there. And then there's one guy, one of the mechanics, if he got a hold of it, it was on some kind of heavy metal rock station, which was just awful, awful stuff. I mean, that's, I don't know how people listen to that. And that's just me talking. I understand most music. I don't understand that. But anyway, I'd had enough. And did I preach? Did I go smash the radio? No, I'm going to tell you what I did. I went to the manager and I just said, look, I said, I can't take that radio anymore. And it was on one of those rock stations. And I even told him, I said, man, I don't like that music. I can't stand it. And I didn't say, you know, I told him, I said, look, I said, I'm going to look for another job. I'm not going to tell you. I didn't even say get rid of it. I just said, look, I said, I don't want to make a scene. I don't want to get anybody in trouble, but I just want to let you know that's driving me crazy. And, you know, if I need to find another job, I will, you know. Well, the manager was like, hey, well, you know, what if we keep it on the country station? That bear was like, well, that's kind of better, but I kind of like it. You know, we kind of laughed about it and stuff. But you know what? The next day I came to work, that radio had disappeared. It had ended up in the garbage, I think, and it really wasn't much account of a radio to even begin with. But no one knew that was just because I, you know, just kind of asked the man, you know, talked to the manager about it. Did I want the radio done? You know, well, yeah, kind of. But, you know, it wasn't about me getting my way. It wasn't about being a jerk or being super spiritual. It just was a little stand that I felt like I needed to take. And I didn't give an ultimatum. I just said, look, I can't stand this. I can't be around it. And I wasn't a jerk about it. I was very kind. And, you know, the manager understood and appreciated it. And he took care of it. I mean, so you don't have to do everything out there and, you know, draw a hard line. Sometimes you can accomplish a lot just by being very humble and going to people, especially if you've developed a relationship. We'll get to that in a minute. But Daniel's stand had the faith to allow it to be tested. Now, this to me is important. A lot of people take a stand, but then they don't like criticism. Then they take a stand and they don't like it when people start poking and prodding at them. If you're going to take a stand, you better have the guts, the intestinal fortitude, the confidence, the faith in what you're doing that you can withstand a little bit of that. If you really believe what you're doing, then when it's put to the test, you shouldn't cry foul or cry persecution. Take your stand and, you know, and hopefully your faith, and you know, you put your faith in something that when it's tested will prove true. Daniel Stan was humble in his request. He wasn't proud. He wasn't arrogant. A quiet, simple conversation between the Prince of the Eunuchs and Melzar. Two conversations he had in private, didn't make a scene, and just very humbly said, hey, I don't really want to eat that food. Will you give me some grade A, you know, best farm fresh organically grown lettuce and this? No, he didn't say, just give me pulse, give me a very simple common meal. So he didn't ask for the moon, he didn't ask for anything extravagant. They said, hey, just give us something very simple, very humble request. You know, they didn't ask for fancy drinks, they asked for water, just very simple as request. Daniel Stan did not affect his other duties. He still learned. At the end of this, we still see that, you know, in the knowledge and everything, when they were put to the test, they were 10 times better than everybody else. So did that stand stop him from doing everything else he's supposed to? No, it didn't. Daniel's stand was not a quick fix, as we saw in the last verse of the chapter. That stand lasted throughout his entire life. Daniel's an amazing individual. He's a man of integrity, a man of character. The Daniel of chapter 1 is the same Daniel throughout his entire life. The Daniel as a teenager is the same as the Daniel when he's 90 years old or however it was. I mean, he is the same person, consistent, integrity. And this wasn't just an opportunist deal. It wasn't just something to make a name for himself or make a scene. You know, he believed, honestly believed what he took a stand in, and it was consistent with that type of stand throughout his life. And then last little point I will make is that Daniel's stand was possible because of the relationships he had built. I think this is important. Too many times today, I think we focus so much on Bible. We focus so much on truth that we forget the relationships with people. There's a little saying that goes something along the lines of, you know, no one cares what you know until they know how much you care. When you go out to present the gospel to people, I'm going to tell you that this cold turkey door knocking stuff is not a very effective way to preach the gospel unless you can win those people over to believe in you and trust you and to see that you care in those couple of minutes at a doorstep. And most people aren't really capable of doing that. You know, because, you know, presenting the gospel, there has to be something of a relationship. Or for it to really be effective, a relationship being there makes it a lot more effective. This stand that he took couldn't have been done if Ashpenaz and Melzar hated him, if he had been a jerk, if they saw him as just a snotty-nosed punk. But they didn't. They saw that Daniel was a good man. They saw his integrity. They saw his character. They saw his faith, and they respected him. And when he made this request, they wanted, even though Ashpenaz turned him down, you know, you can kind of get a little glimpse in there that, you know, he would have done that for him had he not felt that, you know, other circumstances involved there. But I mean, it wasn't, you don't see him just flat turning it down or saying, "Hey, Daniel, you're stupid. Don't ever ask me for anything again." I mean, he cared for him. He wanted to. Daniel's stand's made possible because of those relationships. I'm going to tell you, go back to the story. I hate talking about myself, but the story I told you about the radio at Sears. My boss, and I hope nobody worked with me at Sears finds this out and gets mad at me. I don't think any of them listen to this, but if they ever do and they find out I'm the cause for that radio and they're ones that hold grudges, you know, for what's it been, you know, like 8 years, I may be in trouble. But, but you know, I was able to make that request or take that stand because I was a good worker and because my boss didn't want to lose me and because me and my boss had a relationship. You know, I respected him. I did what he said. I was a good hand. I was a good worker. And so something little about a radio, you know, no big deal. He didn't want to lose me. He wanted me to be happy. You know, other people could have made some kind of request, and he turned them down, you know. Actually, he was super nice, easy to get along with guy. He may not have. But, you know, if I'd been a jerk about a whole bunch of other stuff, do you think he would have listened to me on that? He would have been glad for me to get another job and get rid of me. And I'm going to tell you, I've heard from too many people who used to work with Christians who couldn't stand them. They'll just tell you, "Oh man, they just preached at me the whole time and just never shut up." And, you know, they never took the time to build relationships with these people. And so it doesn't mean you have to go out and live a sinful life with someone to reach somebody. It's not what I mean. But being kind and taking interest in someone's life and, you know, maybe going and getting a bite to eat together. Maybe going to a kid's baseball game or something. I mean, but taking the time to build a relationship with somebody. And it doesn't stop once you get them in. It keeps going. You know, your life really is built on the relationships you have with others, with your family, with the people in your church, with the people at your work, with your neighbors. Life is a series of these relationships. If you want to be a Christian, want to be an effective Christian, a lot of emphasis needs to be put on those relationships to have good, solid relationships with these people so you can influence them for Christ. Well, I need to get off of here. My quiet time's up. My family just drove up. So anyway, I appreciate you listening as we've covered Daniel chapter 1. Next week, we'll get into chapter number 2. Next time I get to record, we'll get into chapter number 2. Maybe I'll be next week. Anyway, I appreciate you listening. Check out BaptistBasics.org for other resources. You can email me at Well, I got a bunch of different email addresses, but webmaster@baptistbasics.org, actually podcast@baptistbasics.org. That's one I've been using on here. And I'd love to hear from you. Leave a rating on iTunes. I'd really appreciate that. Drop me an email. Visit the website for other resources. Anyway, that's it. I appreciate you listening today. Hope it's been helping and blessing to you.